Michael Wolff's new book, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House, prompted a storm of tweeting from President Trump days before it was even available. Since its early release this past Friday, there's been renewed debate over the president's fitness for office and his mental health. Where might the debate lead? Could this storm blow over like many do in the climate of American news? Fire and Fury is published by Henry Holt, and I am thrilled that it brings Michael Wolff back to the show. Welcome back, but my first time being behind the mic with you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that she doubted anybody would be interested in your book. The book is completely sold out. Isn't that correct?
Completely sold out. I mean, we're at a level of this is 50 Shades of Grey, apparently. I don't know.
Of a political sort.
Yes.
I have to tell you, I was at dinner last night in Midtown, and it was a little early, and I had the book with me, and I was reading, and I had it on the banquette next to me, and when I was leaving, you know, you take your stuff with you, picked it up, and the guy at the table next to me just yells out loud, "Holy smokes, how much do you want for that book?"
No, this is a phenomenon. I mean, this book, you know, and only partly due to me, but partly due to the President of the United States, has crossed over into, I guess, cultural phenomenon territory.
So, I mean, as we all know, the president is enraged over what you've reported. Have you heard anything directly from the people you interviewed over the past year about the president being angry about this?
Bouncing off the walls would be what I've heard.
Bouncing off the walls, like add some color to this. I mean, expletive filled rage.
Yes.
Is he berating people for cooperating
yes.
with you?
Everybody is in trouble for this. Everybody is being blamed for this. Everybody is the at the end of a presidential tantrum because of this.
I'm sort of mystified by something. So the president is. Books are written about administrations all the time. Bob Woodward. Of the Washington Post, has made a second career of being sort of the fly on the wall of an administration and reporting out consequential things of an administration. So, you know, your book isn't unusual, but here we have I've never seen a president go on a public tirade against a book, positive or negatively, about his administration. Were you surprised by the president's reaction?
Yes, I mean, I was surprised. I mean, you know, I expected a little some requisite blowback and pushback and largely being cold-shouldered, but this is in some new fantastic territory. Clearly, he seems to regard this book as a mortal threat. Possibly because he's never read a book. I'm truly confused about why this should have elicited a reaction unprecedented in presidential history. The president of the United States is suing me. The president of the United States is suing for invasion of privacy and defamation, two things that actually cannot happen to a president.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting. You say the president is suing you. Now, the president threatens throughout his life. He has threatened lawsuits against people all the time.
Yes, and I should be more precise. Yes, we have received letters from his lawyer saying that we are going to be sued. Will this happen? The truth is, it will probably, of course, never happen, as is so often the case with this president. But even in the White House, I understood. You know, he said, you know, we're going to sue this guy, and everybody says, whoa, that is probably not a good idea. But it happened anyway because he wants what he wants when he wants it.
Mm-hmm. So the picture that you paint in the book and in the super condensed version, the adaptation in New York Magazine, is a harrowing picture. Anyone who's been paying attention to the Trump show of the last year of his administration knows the ins and outs as much as they can about his personality and the way things work or don't work. But in the book, you shine a huge light in corners and crevices that we didn't otherwise wouldn't otherwise see.
I mean,
how? Go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead,
no. I think the thing is, in the interesting. You know, we began this administration from a media point of view with people saying, reporters saying we shouldn't normalize this guy. And in effect, and this is not to take nothing away from the reporting of the daily of the Washington Press Corps, they have normalized him. They've normalized him because it becomes an explosion every day, such that we get used to that and we forget the explosion of the day before. So the advantage of this book and the opportunity that I had, the luxury I had, was to step back and see this in context, in a much broader context, to do effectively the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm. All right. So how on earth did you get the access that you got in the West Wing? I'm a White House hard pass holder. I can go to the White House whenever I want, but I would have to go to the press briefing room, at least under the Obama administration, if I was having a meeting with someone in the West Wing. I'd either wait for them there or in the West Wing lobby to be escorted up to offices. The idea that you were sitting on a sofa in the West Wing for hours as people were going in and out, how were you able to do that? Was it because the President of the United States said, talk to this guy, and so you could just sit there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the perhaps amusing thing is that it was never really talk to this guy. It was more like, so that became the kind of carte blanche that I had. The president doesn't object to this. And then it kind of became, you're supposed to talk to this guy. And then it became, I guess people actually like talking to me, or they like the fact that I listen. So it just took on a kind of velocity. I would make an appointment. I never went in as a member of the press.
You had an appointment with a specific person.
Always. And I would very, very kind of structurally set this up. You know, Mondays were the days that I would make my appointments for the week. Then on Tuesdays, I usually was there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, some part of Friday. And you would go in. You'd make an appointment with somebody at 10 o'clock, and you'd go into the West Wing then, and then you'd wait for them, and they would never show up. So a 10 o'clock appointment was invariably, if you were lucky, a 3 o'clock or a 4 o'clock appointment. So you're sitting there. And the interesting thing about the West Wing is it's very small.
Right.
And the front room is a kind of pass through. Everybody goes through this room, so you see everybody come and go. And so, as I got to know people there, I would be sitting there, and somebody who I wasn't having an appointment with would see me, and they would say, "Hey, and either just sit down and we would chat, or then they would say, "Well, who are you waiting for?" And often, of course, it was Steve Bannon, whom that meant. And then, if you told someone that, they would go, "Oh God, yeah, you're never going to see him." So why don't you come back and talk to me? And so you just became familiar with the place and with the people, and you became sort of part of the furniture. I seem to have another level of reputation, but in person, I'm actually kind of a non-threatening guy. So
your reputation for tearing people's skin off in print.
Right.
But finish your thought.
So you become kind of part of the furniture.
You're listening to Michael Wolff, and he is here to talk about the book you all know about, and some of you have it and some of you don't. It's called Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. Michael, you have people, you're there for an appointment with one person, the person doesn't show up, other people come by, why are you here? They say, oh, well, come back and talk to me. They would tell you the most damaging things about the president, about their rivals, about other people, about what's happening. Were you shocked by what people were telling you and how they were telling you?
Yes, no, I was completely shocked. I mean, I literally went into this project without preconceptions. I would have written a book and kind of anticipated that the book that I might write was a book about a contrarian view in which this unusual president disrupted things in such a way that we at least that he might be successful, or at least it afforded a new way to look at the nature of the presidency. I could have written. I was predisposed to the possibility of writing that kind of book, but then day after day after day. You see how the people closest to the president react. You saw a panic building. You saw and it was a panic that involved how they regarded him, but also how they regarded each other. So at some point in this whole process, it would be that I would speak to, because I was perceived as speaking to Bannon a lot, other factions, the anti-Bannon factions, then decided they had to balance my time with Bannon with their time.
Well, so that was sort of
and they were not saying nice things about Steve, and Steve was not saying nice things about them.
Well, that's a reflection of what we have sort of witnessed for the last year, and what you write about in the book is these various camps were.
Armed camps,
because they each had their own press secretary.
No, that's an extraordinary thing. Structurally, nothing like this has ever happened. And I remember saying to, let me not say who I said this to, but I said,
I mean, feel free to say who you said this to.
Isn't this unusual? And the person says, yeah, it's unusual. So everybody was effectively running a freelance operation there.
You sort of talked about this just a second ago about like the increasing sense of panic, but the atmosphere of those around President Trump, did it really dramatically change over the course of time that you spent with them?
Dramatically.
So it went from panic to unmitigated panic.
It went from a certain kind of qualified optimism. You know, we're going to work in the White House, and that's pretty good. That's an opportunity, and Trump is an oddball, but you know, he was elected president, so that must mean something. And you know, now is the time. We have a Republican Congress. It's we can do something here. So it went from that. And then you would go in, and people would, in the early days, they would give you the line. It was, you know, straight up, you know, Trump is going to do this and we're going to do that. And then it would shift to that they would still be giving you this line, but then they would do it with literally kind of putting a gun to their head, because it almost immediately got nuts. I mean, from that first day, those inaugural numbers of having to defend that, it was indefensible. You know, Sean Spicer, you know, that first day said, you know, you can't make this
expletive up. And one of the words we can't say.
And he would say this again and again and again. That became, everybody was stunned by this and unsure what to do with this. How do you handle this? I mean, from a career point of view, you've reached the pinnacle of your career. You're in the White House. I mean, I sort of set this up at the book as the sort of the fundamental, you know, sort of cosmic joke. You're in the White House. You've gotten a job in the White House, but Donald Trump is president.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you were talking, I was wondering, you have these people who are telling you these most amazing things. They're putting figuratively like a gun to their head and pulling the trigger as if to say, I cannot believe we're talking about this and have to discuss this. But at any point, did you get a sense that the people you were talking to were either they felt that their primary job was to protect the president, protect his interests, or were they there to be a bulwark against the president's worst tendencies?
Yeah, I think many people came to feel they were there to protect the American people.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, this is obviously not everyone, and there's a conflicting set of feelings and justifications among people, but in a strong measure, I mean, there were certainly a core of people there who I came to like and respect.
Who?
I don't want to indicate. I'm sort of in a bind of indicating who exactly I spoke to, but I certainly came to like, respect, and count on the insights of Steve Bannon. I think Reince Priebus is a stand-up guy, is a good at his job, and I think that it would have been worse were he not there.
Reince Priebus.
Yeah.
Even though you even characterize him in the book as somebody who was basically shunted to the side.
I think
the president didn't even want to be president.
I think he had an impossible job from the beginning, but he did it. And if there were 12 tweets in a day, or if there were three bad tweets in a day, there would otherwise have been 12 tweets if it wasn't for Priebus's maturity.
And before we go to a break, you mentioned one of the people that you came to respect and like was Steve Bannon. And Steve Bannon, and I'm speaking for myself here, is someone, to my mind, who should never have been anywhere near the White House, let alone just steps away from the Oval Office with the President of the United States, given his white nationalist
Totally, and not to disagree with that at all, and not to agree with Steve at any point of his agenda, but nevertheless, to say that Steve is intelligent, well-read, focused, a man who can see two steps ahead, a man who is in his approach to his job, even though we might disagree with what he wants to do with that job, a normal person, as opposed to Donald Trump. I mean, we don't know what he believes, but we know his approach to this job has no bearing at all on any of the assumptions we might reasonably make about how you do this job as of being the president of the United States.
And real quickly, I mean, you say that Steve Bannon could see two or three steps ahead, but now, you know, yesterday it was announced Steve Bannon is basically a man with no home, no career, completely blown up as a result of your book. Do you feel any responsibility for what happened to him?
I do, and I feel bad. On a personal level, I feel bad. But you know, as we're all adults here, and when you try to step into history, it's the history
right.
versus one's personal feelings. And I don't know. You know, I would say Steve, I would not count Steve out in any way.
You're listening to Michael Wolff about his book, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House. I'm Jonathan Capehart. This is Midday on WNYC. Later on in the show, Christopher Yates with his new novel, Gristmill Road, and Ben Zimmer, Wall Street Journal language columnist on 2017's Words of the Year. Again, you're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. We are back. I'm Jonathan Capehart. This is Midday on WNYC. And seated before me at the other microphone is Michael Wolff, author of the book you're all talking about, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. Michael, one of the quotes in the book attributed to Steve Bannon is the notion that the meeting at Trump Tower in June of 2016 was, quote unquote, treasonous. There's been a lot of talk about that, but it makes me wonder about something. Has anybody from Robert Mueller's team, his investigative team, contacted you in connection with the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election?
They have not.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Do you think your book sheds any new light where you're anticipating a call from Mueller's
team? I don't know. I mean, what they do is light years different than from what I do. I don't know. You know, there are certain instances at certain key points where members of the Trump inner circle say, and actually in one case on the record, that they believe that an obstruction of justice had occurred by the president. But on the other hand, Mueller can as easily call up that person and have that person testify. I mean, that's actually a more direct route than calling me. I think that probably my book confirms what the Mueller people know, that this is a complete chaos. As a matter of fact, I have a theory, and this is just a theory. Mm-hmm. That Mueller may well not return any indictments because
against the president
and other people in the White House, because I would imagine it could be very hard to prove intent when you are dealing with what are fundamentally incompetent stumblebums.
You know, actually, this gets to something that I want you to respond to. Sarah Kendzior at the Globe and Mail in a column 3 days ago. Let me read you what she wrote. Trump is presented as clueless instead of corrupt, as are the staffers surrounding him. She goes on to write, he may be purposefully ignorant of policy and emotionally volatile, but he understands power and spin, and his 40-year history of dodging criminal prosecution and manipulating the media testifies to a certain kind of skill. It is not the kind of skill that Mr. Trump, or apparently Michael Wolff, wants highlighted. How do you respond to that?
I think it's probably true. Trump is a salesman and a showman. He exists in the moment.
But she's saying he's corrupt.
I profoundly believe the president is corrupt. I think that there's probably money of things that we would call corrupt. The problem here in is that, you know, corruption, you need intent. I don't know. Yes, mm-hmm. Maybe. It's certainly not implausible that Trump has methodically built a financial house of cards for himself. But it is also, I think, as possible that this guy literally just exists in the moment. Mm-hmm. You just do things because you're stupid. Because you can't think things through. You literally can't think two steps ahead. Legally, it's a very complicated thing if you have someone who's done something wrong but literally can't think two steps ahead. So he does these things in the you just can't nail down intent because
he's a stumble bum, he's clueless.
Exists in chaos.
One of the things you do write in the book is that because they all figured, including the now president, didn't think he was going to win, he didn't have to, and they, stretching out all the way to Michael Flynn, didn't feel that they had to change their behavior, their corrupt behavior, because, well, why do I have to worry about it? He's not going to win, and I won't be held accountable.
If you think about this, a perfectly reasonable thing to think. Why should I change what I'm doing, who I am, how I behave for an eventuality that will never come to pass?
there are a couple of questions. People are fascinated by how you were able to get these sources, to get people to talk on the record. You have said in past interviews that you have taped these conversations. So the big question out there is, when are you going to release the interview tapes that you have, that you say you have?
You know, I don't. In the beginning, when people asked me that question, I said, well, I'll never release the tapes. That's not what journalists do. And that isn't what journalists do. But, you know, then I'm thinking, well, maybe times are different. Maybe we're all multimedia specialists. So I don't know the answer to that question. It's come up. I'm thinking about it. Obviously, I have there are a set of other considerations. There are lots of people I have on tape who I gave every assurance to. I mean, I had these discussions, which are on tape too, that sources said, okay, you understand that if anyone asks me if I spoke to you, I am going to deny it. And you have to promise me you will deny it if someone says that to you. So I'm thinking...
And
you know, when I gave
them that assurance,
I absolutely, you know, one of the things about writing this kind of book, and it's you know, I it's not original with me. It is the Woodward style. Mm-hmm. You know, the way you achieve this kind of view inside the White House is that you offer this protection, this veil.
Did you give this veil to Steve Bannon, saying you can go with what I say after I leave the White House?
Yes, that was what. It wasn't even after the White. It was when this book came out. So in other words, he was as long as you don't tell anyone now, you don't write a newspaper article.
I see.
Now.
You don't do anything. You know, it can come out in the book, and I'll be fine.
Yeah, and that was one of the other things about this idea of a book, which is in its own way offers me a kind of veil, because nobody, you know, everybody is worried about what's going to be in the you know, this piece of information that's going to come out within the next 5 minutes. So I'm talking about a book, and they say, well, when is this book going to come out? I say, sometime next year. They go, hey, okay.
Yeah, and next year is here. I got a question from Rachel B19 on Twitter, and she says, one question I have is, at any point while taking notes and recording tapes, did you ever record something so shocking, and then you and that person looked at each other and said mutually, nope, that's not going in the book, then erased it?
A few instances. I wouldn't say I ever erased it, but a few instances of things that were so shocking that I thought, you know, I would like to get this in, and then did not have the absolute confidence, given the level of shockingness, that I could get it into the.
Okay, so it wasn't that you chose to keep it out because it was too shocking.
No.
You chose to keep it out because you could not confirm it.
Exactly.
To
right.
Like, airtight status.
Right.
I have a question from Sarah Policano on Facebook from South Carolina, and she's asking, in the wake of so many high-profile departures from the White House, who or what will be the thing that allows some semblance of sanity going forward? Is that even possible in this White House?
I think in a way it becomes more insane. At least in the first 6 or 7 months of this White House, you had a set of professionals who were trying to. They were political professionals. That was their they at some level understood their job.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, and this is it's astounding to me. I mean, the president's two senior most advisors. One would be Hope Hicks, who's 28 or 29, a former junior level fashion PR person, and Stephen Miller, who I think we all saw over the weekend,
Tapper, yes.
blow apart on national TV. I mean, these are the two people, the president's senior most advisors. They neither have in any way, shape, or form the experience, the mm-hmm. Maturity, the
The gravitas.
Yes.
This fits perfectly in with a question from David Phillips from Alexandra, who asked me on Facebook, is there anyone in the executive office of the president whom you believe is actually qualified to perform well in the job for which they were hired or the job they're doing now?
You know, I think General Kelly is an admirable man in every way, and a man of integrity, and a man who understands the job he has to do. I think it's probably very difficult for him. I think that he regards the president with an amount of scorn. I would not be confident that he will be in that role for all that much longer. I think it's just an impossible job to do. But I also think that he believes that he is there to protect the American people in their, as it were, hour of need.
Let's come back. Let's end where we started, and that was the threat from the president to sue you and to sue your publisher. Your publisher, in responding to the lawyers responding, said that the president's threat was an act of trying to silence criticism.
Well, yes, obviously. Obviously it is.
And your lawyer's response to the Trump's cease and desist demand referred to documents in the possession of Donald Trump and his family, hinting that a Trump legal action would force disclosure of material the president wants to keep secret. Didn't your lawyer did say that?
Indeed.
Isn't one of the things you would love actually to be sued by the president?
I'm sure I'm not supposed to say that, but I could see a future book, let's call it Deposing the President.
Well, and that gets to the key thing. If the president does indeed follow through in filing suit against you, there's this magical period called discovery.
Yes.
And with discovery is a deep, dark place that is much more perilous for the president than it would be for you.
Yes. I have my taxes are available. So we'll get his, I guess we can discover the, it's just preposterous. It's not going to happen. He cannot do this. This is why everybody in the White House, when this happened, I'm going to sue, is thinking, what is he doing? Does he have any conception of what he's saying, of what he's beginning, of what road he would be going down here? And the answer is no, he has no conception.
And you mentioned, you know, your tax returns are out there. The president hasn't released his tax returns. If in this period of discovery, there are all sorts of other things that have nothing to do necessarily with money that could open the president up to all kinds of exposure in terms of his past dealings here in New York City.
If for sure.
So this morning, President Trump has been tweeting about the witch hunt over ties to Russia and sneaky Dianne Feinstein. Do you think that now that the president's been completely exposed in this book as somebody who is vindictive and petty and totally not interested really in the actual job of being president, that what we're seeing on Twitter will actually just get worse, that his condition will get worse?
So I think so far that's what we've seen has been happening, yes.
Are you already working on a part two?
I am not. the interesting thing about this is that this book was finished on November 15th, so I am hardly still emerging from this experience.
Michael Wolff, thank you very much for being here. Michael Wolff is the author of the explosive new book, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House. It's the first book this administration has tried to block from publication, but you can buy it now if you can find it. Michael Wolff, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.